Hello and welcome to my chopping board. That's the sound of me, Andre Vornik, getting rid of the stems of artichokes and doing my best to trim off those annoying woody bits to make carciofia alla romana. It's a quintessentially local dish here in Rome. The artichokes are seasonal and they came by courier, ordered online from a family farm on the fringes of the city. All of this makes me feel rather good about myself, and that's the case for many other people who, during the lockdown, have partly switched away from mass-produced food and towards more nutritious items and shorter supply chains. But of course, that's still something that many of us just cannot afford.
With hidden hunger, you do not have enough of the vitamins and minerals.
When she was a young girl, Anna Larti saw a door in a hospital in her native Ghana with a sign on it that said nutritionist, and she knew that was what she wanted to be. Decades later, she's retiring as director of nutrition for FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, and she's doing so on a stark note.
3 billion people globally do not have access to healthy diets. In Africa, about 1 billion people do not have access to healthy diets. We are talking about regions where they have agriculture as the mainstay. At the moment, in many regions of the world, a bottle of sugar-sweetened beverage is cheaper than if you want to buy a fruit. We need to change all of these.
Those numbers come from one of FAO's flagship annual reports. They reflect the increasing profile that nutrition has acquired at the organization during the tenure of people like Larti.
Vitamin A, incredibly important for eyesight. Iron, very important for mental capacity. Zinc, very important for growth and sexual development and reproduction.
Boosting the world's intake of beneficial micronutrients was already within FAO's mandate back in 1945. But in that early rush to improve production and yields, it was put on the back burner for the first few decades. Not any longer. In 2020, FAO calculated that making healthy diets universally affordable would save $3 trillion a year in health and environmental costs.
My name is Jessica Fonzo. I'm a Bloomberg Distinguished Professor at Johns Hopkins University in the United States.
You've worked for FAO in the past. When you were there, how did you see nutrition, that kind of dimension, feed into FAO's programs?
Well, in the long discombobulated politics of food security, nutrition has been having its moment over the last decade or two. So when I got to FAO, so in 2018, it was about how do we ensure that agriculture and food systems are reoriented to ensure they address nutrition. And we've added this other level of complexity over the last few years, in that FAO is not only just thinking about undernutrition, but overweight and obesity. With both undernutrition and overweight and obesity, outcomes of poor diets. And those poor diets are born from agriculture and food systems. So FAO plays a really central role in that, and they've come to realize how important that role is. It's no longer just about keeping people alive, but actually letting them thrive.
This speaks to a recent trend in global development, a trend that sees food security as one piece of an interlocking puzzle of needs and aspirations. In the previous episode of this podcast, we heard from the Canadian environmental historian Andrew Watson. He says diets are an entry point into a broader discourse about what we value as human societies.
One of the ways that a lot of people get into discussions about food is from the health perspective, right? Obesity is a huge issue. Leading a healthy lifestyle. There are so many ways in which thinking about these issues can lead us into a conversation on a larger scale within country to country, but also in a global sense of food issues, agricultural issues, as encapsulated in environmental justice issues and social justice issues. This has become, increasingly important as we are thinking about the impacts of climate change on the global south, recognizing that the ways in which we engage in a particular diet is actually not just about an individual outcome, but it has a lot to do with social structures, recognizing that to address the inequalities of our food system is to address larger systemic problems of inequality around the world too, that obesity and diabetes are in some contexts a reflection of overconsumption, and that this needs to be matched with a recognition that the agri-food systems that we have in place do very little to facilitate a sort of an equitable distribution of the world's food production capacity.
You know, food cuts across so many different policies, whether it's agriculture, environment, economics. And I think the COVID pandemic has really shown that, how central health systems are, but also food systems, and that they cut across every aspect of society.
Isn't there a danger that when you say that everything is about everything, how does that really translate into public policy? Because there comes a point where you think, where do I grab this by, if I do put it this way?
We need to embrace the complexity and figure out ways to work through that complexity. And that makes it very difficult for policymakers, because if they have to press all the buttons at once, you know, there's going to be trade-offs in doing that. But I think for a long time in the food world, we've looked for silver bullets and singular approaches. And it really hasn't done us very well, has it? We have massive burdens of malnutrition now. Total environmental degradation, climate disruption, significant inequities. And we need to just get out of that mindset that one thing will save it all. And you still hear that a lot. Well, if we just focus on biofortification, or if we just focus on improving yields, or if we focus on vitamin A supplementation, things will be okay. But we just know that's not true anymore.
My name is Carol Collins. My main activity is managing a policy assistance facility, which is a joint facility with the European Union, whereby we provide policy support to governments around the world around food systems transformation.
Carol Collins is one of the people at FAO who must think systemically, with an eye on the Sustainable Development Goals, a set of 17 benchmarks adopted by the United Nations General Assembly. The goals include ending poverty, eradicating hunger and all forms of malnutrition, but also the pursuit of peace and the rule of law. And this, says Callens, involves a certain amount of institutional acrobatics.
On the one hand, of course, I think working at the level of policies and sort of the macro level is really fundamental, because that's where you can have impacts, or you can obtain, you create the conditions for obtaining impact at scale. At the same time, of course, the reality is that many, many people in the world are still marginalized and need direct support. And that is true in particular in crisis countries. And as we know, there are still many, many countries in the world that are in crisis situation. But also you may find that within countries that are otherwise doing reasonably well, you still have population groups, geographical areas that are left behind. And so it's in the spirit of leave no one behind that as an organization, we're still very much involved in providing direct support to people, but always bearing in mind that at the end of the day, you want to find structural solutions to the problems that they are facing. So it's this whole, what we call in our language, the humanitarian development peace nexus, where the work that you do in the humanitarian context needs to be connected to what we do in terms of development work and the policy agenda. And very often there's a peace dimension, because a lot of these countries are or areas are in crisis because of conflict. So there is this connection that we need to look after.
I give the floor to the representative of Netherlands.
Thank you very much, Madam President. I deliver this statement on behalf of the co-pen holders that put forward the resolution on conflict and hunger, Côte d'Ivoire, Kuwait, Sweden, and the Netherlands. As stated in the Secretary General's report on protection of civilians, the number of food insecure people is rising, mainly due to armed conflict. Recent reports from WFP and FAO confirm this deeply concerning trend. The resolution before us is a landmark text. For the first time, this council unequivocally condemns the use of starvation as a method of warfare.
Some may be skeptical about Security Council resolutions, but that is to forget that a unanimous resolution, such as this one, number 2417, adopted 2 years ago, is a precious thing. It carries the moral authority of the entire international community. For FAO, moving policy in the highest political fora highlights a massive shift from the time of its creation. It is now much more of an advocacy and convening body than a corps of engineers who knew how to get more milk out of cows or more rice out of paddies.
We came from an era where FAO had expertise in basically all the sectors and the subsectors, even sort of divided by specific crop types, oil crops and cereals, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, that is no longer necessary. All this kind of expertise is now available around the world. And so I think our role has evolved dramatically in being much more of at the interface between what I would call science and policy. So where the expertise does not necessarily sit within FAO, but sit within the partners that we work with, whether these are academia, think tanks, private sector organizations. And then we provide interface with those in government and elsewhere who make decisions about the economy, the agriculture, their businesses. So we really sort of have become much more of an interface, a broker between the knowledge and the decision-making process.
Alla fine della call vengono delineati sei principi che possono trasformare l'innovazione tecnologica in un qualcosa che abbia il bene dei singoli.
That was the launch at the Vatican of a Rome call for AI ethics. A first ever coalition between FAO, tech giants, and the Catholic Church to lay down common principles for the use of artificial intelligence. Because one other thing that has changed fundamentally since 1945 is the rate of innovation in the food sector. Ours is an era of app-controlled cultures, vegetal skyscrapers, and roads paved with soybeans. This quantum leap means that FAO must be more of an arbiter in matters of food governance. But it also questions the ancestral connection between farming and food. The notion, in other words, that what we put in our mouths must necessarily come from the soil. Or conversely, that the fruits of the soil must predominantly end up in our stomachs.
Andrew, do you think in the very near future we will arrive at a point where agriculture is in effect delinked from the land?
I really hope not, Andre. The risk there is that by thinking about being able to produce food on a scale that we're talking about here to meet the needs of 10 billion people by the middle of the century, we're talking about a variety of inputs of nutrients and energy, which I don't think exist. Agroecosystems that are based inherently in the land have so many energy and material flows that run through them that are not controlled by humans that we rely on, and that we start to imagine moving away from them, we are getting ourselves into a scenario with a scale of unintended consequences we haven't seen before.
It's an interesting question in the sense that, different people may have different views on that. But I think what you see now is that on the one hand, we are developing very technology intensive, high tech agriculture, whereby almost people are growing crops without connection to the soil in urban areas. So this also fits with the idea that we need to bring food production closer to where the consumption is. On the other hand, of course, there's a whole group of people who are looking at sort of the agroecological approaches and whereby you see a movement towards a kind of agriculture which is much better integrated with the natural environment. I think what's clear is that further area expansion for agriculture, that is not an option. On the other hand, there's also the notion that agriculture is these days is about more than producing agriculture products and food. There's the whole idea around what we call the bioeconomy. So there are all these other uses that we can make of the natural resource base.
What technologies do you see emerging as we go forward?
Well, I think one really fascinating area of development from a scientific and innovation perspective is what I would call the microbiome science. So it's basically this notion that there is a vast number of microbiological resources, species, etc., that we are just discovering now that we didn't know before, and which we started to understand have a fundamental role in everything we do, from human health, soil health, the health of our oceans, carbon capture, etc. So we're starting to understand the role of the microbiome and specific species within the microbiome in all these different functions. But also we're starting to understand how we can make use of these microbiological resources for our economy. So if you think about the production of new antibiotics, alternative proteins that could be replaced, for example, animal proteins, there's new applications in terms of plant protection. There's a role in animal nutrition. To me, that is the most promising area of future innovation and technological development.
Ultimately, it's not either or, right? Technology, of course, has an important role to play, but we fundamentally need a different kind of mindset too. The technology alone will not save us. The thing that heartens me a great deal is that there are so many wonderful examples of people who are engaged with community-based approaches to agriculture. So even if those aren't huge right now, they provide us with a model. They provide us with examples of alternatives that either we can adopt by making hard choices and accepting a different relationship to energy, for example, or we could be obliged to begin to make those shifts. But either way, we've got examples that are there for us when we start to make more fundamental shifts in our culture.
Well, let me bring that straight back down to earth here in Rome, because my artichokes are pretty much done. They've been sweating away with olive oil, water, a bit of garlic, some parsley, a touch of salt. Now, I don't know if tomorrow's artichokes will still come from the soil or not, or indeed, if it might become possible to use artichokes in a whole bunch of tertiary applications that are yet to be dreamed up. What I do know is that I'm happy to have them, but I'm also aware that some 700 million people around the world cannot enjoy something as simple as this. So, as I wish you happy holidays, I would urge you to think of these 700 million, but to think of them not just charitably for once. Think of them systemically, because hunger is not a fatality. Here's hoping that the world agrees on that sooner rather than later. All the best.